Welcome to the Women's Success Summit, brought to you today by the Public Speakers Association. I'm so excited to introduce to you the incredible Ms. Rosemary Barnes. Rosemary, why don't you take it from here?
Thank you, Tonya. It's such a pleasure to be here today. I am in the middle of writing my second book, and it is called Confident Leadership in the 21st Century, Bridging the Generation Gaps. We have such a brilliant workforce, but nobody quite knows what to do with them. They're upset, we're upset, and what's happening is that we're not able to get the best out of each other for each other. So I am in the midst of writing a book, so I'm very pleased to tell you that today's topic is exactly that, on how to bridge the leadership gap in 21st century business from everybody's point of view. Now, please understand before I begin that I am one of those people who is tired beyond belief of the millennial bashing that has been going on ad nauseum. Now, I know there are a lot to handle. They know there are a lot to handle. And what's more is they are desperately unhappy. Who is supposed to change? They're not going to. That leaves us in a bit of a pickle. And pickled leaders are just not that much fun to be around. So what does it take to be a leader that can mold and nourish and shape our younger generations into truly productive workforce members and let them show the brilliance that they have within? Lao Tzu said, a good leader inspires people to have confidence in him. A great leader inspires people to have confidence in themselves. And that's what our younger generations are missing. They do not have, for all their bravado, they don't have very much confidence because they've never been allowed to navigate through failure, and that's where confidence comes from. Business leaders are becoming increasingly frustrated by these changing attitudes. Not only do leaders and managers need to keep on top of all this rapid technological change and advances, but the job seekers are actually changing the very face of how business is conducted. Now, remembering that I am not a millennial basher and I'm using gross generalities only to make a point, millennials are brilliant, but they're also seen as entitled and with no internal motivation. Then we get Generation Z, the latest to begin to hit the job market, and with tremendous knowledge and technological astuteness, but they will not abide the pyramidal corporate structures so common today. The question then is, how can the immense combined power of these groups of individuals be harnessed for the success of a company? You know, being a leader in today's business world is a little bit like being a ringleader in a circus. To be successful, the circus ringleader needs to supply the lion tamers with a chair and a whip. The trapeze artists require their swings and a net. And the trick riders must have their horses and special saddles. Well, similarly in business, the good leader is aware that Generation X prefers carefully funneled information. Generation Y feeds on mentorship and praise. And the upcoming Generation Z needs to understand how their tasks fit in the whole big picture. In this new age, the role of the leader has also changed. What qualifies an individual as a leader today? Is it the role that they play? Is it the skills that they bring? Is it their title? Great leaders don't always have the title of the boss. And they're not always the bossy ones either. Leaders can arise out of ordinary circumstances and in all age groups. There are leaders on the playground, on work crews, in offices, on governing boards, and even in retirement homes. there are natural leaders, and then there are those who have learned the skills. True leaders are not bullies ruling through power and fear. They have no need of coercion or deception. They inspire others to greatness, and they're not threatened by the accomplishments of others. That's never changed. That's the same today as it always has been. What about in business? What skills and attributes do great business leaders possess that encourage their executives and managers and supervisors and all the employees of today's hugely diverse population to jointly contribute to the success of a company and at the same time provide opportunities and support for these very same individuals to become innovators and leaders themselves? The 20th century version of leadership has all but disappeared, and leaders are reeling, not knowing how to bridge the huge generation gaps that exist in business today. The first thing that we have to clarify is the difference between leadership and management. They are not the same thing. We need them both, and we need them to be paired like a fine wine with a fine meal. They have to work with synchronicity. But you do have to know what the difference is. Management is the authority granted to an individual by an organization. Leadership is the authority granted to an individual by their followers. Alexiyama from The Mystique of Leadership said, leadership is only effective when management is efficient. They have to go hand in hand. And Stephen Covey said, effective leadership is putting first things first. Effective management is discipline, carrying it all out. He also said that management is efficiency in climbing the ladder of success. Leadership determines whether the ladder is leaning on the right wall in the first place. Some individuals are leaders even when in a position of management, and some are managers even when in a leadership situation. Now, larger companies have the luxury of both positions, but smaller companies and entre or solopreneurs have to wear both hats. It's important to recognize when managerial responsibilities begin to force out the leadership role, just as it's equally important to fulfill your management role even when you're knee-deep in the leadership process. The skills of the two may overlap in a number of instances, but when one or the other is missing, the effects are felt throughout the company. The question for today's people in business is whether the essence of the roles of leadership and management have endured the test of time, or whether they've evolved to something completely different. George Washington was a great leader in the United States, and it was his primary interest to support his men as they fought the battles. George Washington was ahead of his time. Today we are all so clever, and we have named a process called outcome-based thinking, which is essentially is you begin with the end already determined. Once you know where you're going, the paths to get there become clearer. He was a leader in that way. He saw what needed to be done, and then he organized everything that had to come together to reach that end result. That's leadership. You have to know how to make decisions, though. To be a true leader, you have to know how to make decisions. Disney's son said, when your values are clear to you, making your decision becomes easier. Every business leader has to know their capabilities. And to do that, they must first know who they are, what their values are, what their passions are, the culture they want to build. and most importantly, to what lengths they will go to achieve that desired outcome. They have to know and be able to answer the question, who am I? Now, this doesn't mean your name and your rank and serial number. Knowing who you are means that you understand why you're here and the unique contributions you intend to make, not only to yourself, but to your organization and to the larger world. It means you know your purpose in life and you can articulate it well. And in so doing, you can engage and inspire other people. Leaders have to know what their passions are. And this doesn't just mean to the current generation or the past generation. It means to everyone. And they have to be able to state it clearly, emphatically, and with the passion they feel for it. It's not about whether you're passionate about food and wine and football. It's the understanding of passion that's essential for you to lead well. And it requires deep insights into who you are, what you feel, and what drives you. Leaders have to know how they impact other people. A leader's critical responsibility is to design and maintain the culture of his organization. If your staff feel free to debate and discuss issues and then work together to get at the best result, it's because the leader has cultivated that culture and where people are encouraged to take risks and make innovations. The final key element are knowing where your edges are. Where are the leader's boundaries? To do that, you really have to know your values. Without knowing your values, you can't know how far you can be pushed. Values are the key to leadership, and they guide our leadership style. Every great leader, everyone, spends a lot of time discovering and uncovering their core values, and then continually monitors them to check for changes. Our values do change over time. If we don't keep track of what those changes are, we lose sight of them, and then we lose our way. If we don't know what we believe today, how can we know that our goals are worthy? Further, we must absolutely know what our goal is, else how can we possibly chart an effective route to get there? How can we lead our people to our goal if we don't know what it is? We have to commit 100% to reaching that goal. Otherwise, how can we persuade others to join us? Now add all the generation gaps that are happening in business, coupled with the changing motivations of the new workforce, and we find out that former leadership styles and techniques don't work anymore. Working harder and becoming even more firm in our dedication is not enough to reach our goals or the goals of the company. Leaders are faced with creating and choosing possibilities and paths, making decisions that can affect the entire business and its people, fulfilling the need to continually inspire and motivate, both inside and without the walls of the business. A leader has to be perceived as confident but not arrogant, bendable but not breakable, and responsive as opposed to reactive. The secret to making it all look easy and secure is for the leader to live their values and let them guide every decision they make. The other very big one for all leaders, and one that's ignored a little bit, is communication. It is impossible to overstress the importance of communication skills for leaders. Of the plethora of talent, skills, and aptitudes necessary the value of communication trumps them all. After all, an idea remains only an idea unless action follows. And without brilliantly sharing with all the parties in the language they need to hear, no action can ever occur. The brilliant idea dies before it can even take root. During the ages of command and control leadership, the leadership of the past, communication skills played an enormous role, but because of the tendency of the workforce to simply obey commands from on high, persuasion skills weren't as vital as they are today. Asking why would have been outrageous in the middle of the 20th century, whereas today, leaders expect the question, at least the good ones do. This is one of the most common complaints current business leaders have. The workforce is demanding to know the whys of every request. Now, there's a disconnect, you see, between the boss expecting the commands to be completed and the employees wanting to understand the reason for the request. The former tends to feel threatened by the questioning, while the latter believe if they know the why, they can do a better job. It all boils down to a communication issue and an understanding of the amount of information to share. Business leaders, sad to say, tend to live under the false illusion that they can speak to their colleagues and counterparts and employees the same way as they speak in casual conversation. This one mistake causes more damage than they know. Leaders must accept that when they say even one single word about their business, no matter to whom, they are giving a formal public speaking presentation. Now, public speaking is an art form in and of itself and requires dedicated study and practice to be done well. The benefits of speaking well are immense, as are, unfortunately, the negative effects of not speaking well. Whether it's one-to-one, one-to-a-few, or one-to-many, speaking of business must be handled with finesse, be designed to address the listener's top-of-mind problem, and always answer their burning questions of what's in it for me and how does this affect me. All of that is another book unto itself, and happily one is available to you. Confident Public Speaking, Being Heard Above the Noise, has been reviewed as an excellent book for learning the essentials of speaking in business. It's a very good book, I know, because I wrote it. In all sincerity, the value of honed and practiced speaking skills is tremendous and will allow you to persuade and inspire and engage your employees and audiences much, much more effectively. Leaders must reach excellence in so many areas, and speaking and communication skills must rightfully be placed at the very top of that whole list. In the 21st century, business leadership is no longer defined as a corner office with a door. It's no longer enough to understand profit and loss and marketing and selling and business-to-business association. Softer skills, such as people skills and communication skills and delegation skills, have become hugely important. Why the change? What has happened to cause such an about-face of the expectation of leaders in business? The answer lies in the change of attitudes and expectations of the workforce. And those attributes are very, very different than what has gone before. It's an interesting time to be a leader. It wouldn't be at all outrageous to see four generations of people working under the same roof and being led by a single vision. We've got the baby boomers, who were born 1945 to 1960-ish, Generation X, 1960 to 1980, Generation Y, also known as the Millennials, from 1980 to about 2000, and Generation Z, for the upcomers who were born 2000 and later. All of these generations are motivated by completely different ideals. Generation X are the nose to the grindstone post-war generation, skeptical, suspicious, and loyal. We've got the I turned up, so I deserve only the best millennials. And we've got the fearless and analytical Generation Z group. Modern business demands that leaders understand how to motivate, how to lead through involvement, and how to encourage and reward innovative thinking, because that's what the generations are demanding. Leaders today, and this is a quote, leaders today have to be astute enough to know how to tap into the strengths of each of these groups, creative enough to motivate them on their own terms, and insightful enough to bridge the differences so collaboration between them is possible. It demands communication expertise, such that each group understand their roles, and critical thinking skills to see what's working and what's not. Finally, and most importantly, leadership today demands the capability to not only adapt to change and innovation, but to actively and seriously pursue it, end quote. Wow, no pressure there. All right, let's clarify and define these generations a little bit. Baby boomers were such a huge group that went on for quite a while. So they've actually been divided into Boomers 1 and Boomers 2. Boomers 1, the first wave, were born between 1946 and 1954-ish into a world of promise. For them, work was an exciting adventure in a brave new and post-war world. Most of those individuals have entered retirement, but some of them are still living their business dream and are having a great time doing it. These individuals needed to hear that they were important to the success of the business. That was their motivator. The second wave of baby boomers, 1955 to 65, are verging on retirement. For them, work was still an adventure, but it became a little bit more arduous than for the first block. This group became a little bit disillusioned with the business leaders of the day and didn't really trust them to have my interests at heart. Baby boomers, too, needed to hear that they matter. Okay, on comes Generation X. These people were born between 1963 and 1980. These were the first generation of latchkey kids. They were survivors. They were skeptical and they were self-reliant. They are a large part of today's workforce and they tend to be some of the leaders simply by time served and experience. These individuals are self-starting free agents. They enjoy technology, but they tend to be a little suspicious of everyone else's motivations. They view their work as a necessary challenge, something that must be done to pay for the weekends on their boat. These individuals value having their superiors, their leaders, hear them and know that their opinions are valued. On to Generation Y, the generation that has caused all this kerfuffle. Much maligned masses of millennials. This group has turned the world on its head. For them, work is simply a means to an end. They ask why about everything, and they cause infinite frustration to the reigning authority. They demand and need to be respected by their leaders. They crave instant gratification. And they want to know that they and their co-workers can turn this place around. Generation Z is just beginning to enter the workforce. They're eager to participate and have no patience, none, for repetition. This is the generation that was born with an umbilical cord and an electrical cord to plug in their technological gadgets. They wield technology brilliantly. This group sees work not as a means to an end, but as a means to a better world. They tend to view things from a global perspective, and they need to know that the world needs them. Savvy employers are aware that Generation X prefers carefully funneled information. Generation Y feeds on mentorship and praise. And the upcoming Generation Z are demanding respect for their technological prowess and their big picture mentality. In order to strengthen multi-generational relationships, leaders need to understand the needs and the values and the motivational forces that speak to each of these groups, and furthermore, subdivide the groups into what each individual needs. The past versions of decision-making and leadership is on its way out. It's threatened. And our leaders and managers are reeling because they don't know what to do about it. We are smack dab in the middle of a massive upheaval in societal and business norms. And being successful is requiring that we respect the systems of the past, retain the portions that still have value, and adapt to the new expectations. We have to have an awareness of what generations X, Y, and Z need. We interact with people of all ages in our businesses, in our personal lives, in our social lives. Whether we are engaging with staff or clients or children, understanding the differences in values and motivators will make you a leader, a better communicator, an employer, a parent, and a business person. Change has always been inevitable. The only difference is that now it's happening faster than ever before. Once upon a time, humans lived in caves and communicated through body language and the occasional grunt. The discovery of fire caused massive change as it did the invention of language. We changed from searching for food to cultivating it. The ripples of change resulting from the invention of the printing press quickly turned into a tsunami of written communication. It really wasn't that long ago that women were finally deemed to be people and not mere possessions, and they created an upheaval as big as the one we're going through now. Millennial generation, Generation Y, are unfocused and entitled and self-absorbed and all those other adjectives you've heard. And they cannot survive without their cell phones. They've grown up playing video games and they expect instant gratification. They can't make a decision without consulting everybody and their puppy. We generally consider them to be lazy, and that they expect respect just for showing up. Now, does this all sound familiar? It should, because similarly harsh criticisms of each and every new generation have rung through the rafters time after time. Think back to the panicked parents of teenagers when chubby checkers became popular. Do you remember the rebels created by the Beatles? And what about the sacrilegious burning of draft cards? Think back through history. Young upstarts have created chaos with every passing generation. And for that, we should be absolutely grateful. Without new and innovative ideas, nothing changes. And without change, we first stagnate and then we fall into ruin. Do you really think that Benjamin Franklin's parents thought he was brilliant for playing outside in a storm with a kite? Do you think Thomas Edison's peers cheered him on to create the first light bulb? Or did they quietly snicker and laugh at him behind his back? Is there really anything different about this generation's progress than what has come before? Yes. And yes, again. While our Generation Y group may well be entitled and demanding and even arrogant, let us remember that it was us that raised them to know they were special. We bought them trophies even when they lost, and we rewarded them for anything and everything they undertook. Through buying them electronics, we taught them to understand the world of quick responses and have the instant information of the world at their fingertips. They took advantage of every opportunity to learn the complex world of computers, and we praised them for their ingenuity in solving problems in the flash. We provided cell phones to them so we could keep in touch with them, and they took advantage of that technology to keep in touch with the world and with each other. Never before has a generation made such advances in such a short time. But every generation has changed the world. Generation X caused huge disruption. Generation Y, even more so. And now enter from stage left, Generation Z. If ever there was a group more poised, ready, and capable of making great advances and massive improvements to our planet, I don't know what it might be. Where previous generations were fearful of change and determined to hold on to the status quo, Generation Z views it as exciting and normal. They have never known a world without cell phones and computers and multiple personal devices. Generation Z is being raised amid institutional and economic instability, informed by the looming shadow of depleting resources and planetary warming, and are globally connected via social media. They have always had information at their fingertips, and they are masters of analytics. They're also prone to social anxiety and tend to get ulcers by the age of 9. So let's wrap this comparison up here for a minute. Attitude toward authority is a huge component of the differences. The boomers won. They looked at authority with honor and respect. Boomers two viewed authority with disillusionment and certainly not with trust. Generation X was skeptical and suspicious. Generation Y needs to be respected by the leaders, and Generation Z needs to be valued by their leaders. Where work was before 1980 tended to be a team, maybe, or a lot of individual work. Now, after 1980, we've got virtual teams. Where we used to have to work in a factory or an office, now we can work at home or while we're away. We used to have customer service, now we've got call centers. We used to take jobs and keep them for life, now 2 years seems to be about appropriate, and we tend to change our careers about every 7 years. Employees used to be isolated from each other and from what happened outside the walls of the business, now everybody is connected. You know, one of the things that really, really had a huge influence on the changes that we see happening are women. specifically the rise of women in the workforce. And I'm going to give you statistics now because, you know, I have to be credible. In 1976, 36% of women in their early 40s had given birth to four or more children. Only 22% gave birth to two children. So we've got 36% with over four kids and 22% with only two. Now, compare that to 2014, where it's flipped completely around. Only 12% had four children and 35% had two. So they're diametrically opposite. Now, reasons for this about face include the availability of the birth control pill and the growth of women's participation in the workforce and the rising costs of having children. During World War I and World War II, women proved that they were capable of working jobs more typically assigned to men. At the same time, more women were entering and graduating from universities and further were continuing on to postgraduate programs. That all resulted in the age of marriage and having first children rising dramatically. The right to socially accepted birth control, including abortion, allowed women more control over their situations, ultimately resulting in many more women in powerful business leadership roles. Where previous decision makers, being the majority male, were predominantly left-brain driven, logical, and linear, female leaders now added new ingredients and perceptions into the mix. The rise in the power of women's rights changed the status quo, not only in business and politics and the military, but in our homes. Where traditionally it was the fathers wielding ultimate power and final say, as in just wait till your father gets home, women were no longer satisfied to accept the submissive role. That challenged the preconceived ideas of proper child rearing. Where once it was considered a weakness, for example, for men to, or young boys to cry, all of a sudden it began to be more appropriate that men are in touch with their feelings. Young men previously preened into becoming the man of the house and following in their father's footsteps as quickly as possible, now we're being encouraged to explore their options and choose a path that would tend to their emotional happiness. With women having fewer children and by virtue of our genetic maternal instinct, each child women had began to take on more significance. What with working 40 hours and more each week, mothers tended to be somewhat loath to let a moment of their offspring's precious childhood slip by, and they subconsciously strove to make up for lost time by encouraging their children to remain young for as long as possible. Since the wives and mothers were working full time, household chores started to become more fairly split between the spouses. And without the more natural ease of the maternal instinct to guide the men internally, the men followed the examples that the women set. And that set the stage for our entitled generations. Education followed suit. Budget constraints and hierarchies demand that schools be run as businesses, with projected population numbers being the basis for the government allotted monies. Schools have to attract the very best teachers to ensure that the boards are satisfied, and increasingly to make sure students were successful. Until quite recently, school trustees and principals were predominantly male. Discipline was strict and corporal punishment was the norm. Children sat in rows and they did their work individually and silently. Libraries were full of books and talking about the reading materials was definitely not encouraged. Teachers and principals were authorities, and parents echoed that sentiment at home. Schools maintained that untouchable hierarchy, with the principals having to walk both the managerial and the leadership roles. Where once strapping students was punishment, pure and simple, the softer appeal of behavior modification incentives started to become more prevalent, and the primarily female teachers were quick to adopt that new attitude. Students were permitted to bring more individuality to their assignments, and teachers were responsible for guiding them to find their individuality. Soon enough, the role of the teacher began to morph from the lecturer at the front of the room to something very different. Teachers became more like learning facilitators, and students' rights became all important. Do you think it's a coincidence that education has become more child and individual centric as women have accepted decision-making roles in education? Doubtful. Did you ever watch My Big Fat Greek Wedding? Fabulous movie. The mother of the bride said, "The man may be the head, but the woman is the neck and can turn the head any way she wants." With gender responsibilities no longer being as clear as in years past, the role of the family head is now more commonly split among available talent. As in education, Generation Y and Z are demanding more individual attention and emotional care at home, in education, and in the work world. They want to be nurtured and guided. And that's the strength of the right-brained people. Given the needs of the current workforce, it seems that the strength of women, of the right-brained, might become in very high demand. In business, leadership roles are still sought and achieved by more men than women. But it won't be too much longer before gender equalization sees a more equitable balance. It will be interesting to see that if in and of itself, women have a bigger influence on closing the gap between the generations in business. Recently on Facebook, there was an article written by Simon Sinek about the dopamine effect and what it's done to Generation Y. But in my opinion, the dopamine effect is equally powerful on all generations. The dopamine effect is that feel-good feeling, the one that makes you feel happy, powerful, secure, confident. I think people are addicted to it, but it's not just for Generation Y. Imagine that you are living in an age where birth control is readily available to the masses, and you now have control over family planning. You have delayed that first baby until the time is right. Food and shelter and clothing are no longer the prime consideration, and the hormonometer is screaming for procreation. Finally, unto you a child is born, cute as a bug's ear, and undeniably bound for greatness. You have researched parenting techniques, a safety-conscious crib, a pacifier that will not harm tooth development, and toys that promise to supply appropriate stimulation and learning opportunities. You know how and what to feed your innocent babe and what to expect at every stage of development. Here comes the dopamine effect. the very first time you pop that special pacifier into your child's mouth and hear the suckling sounds as he or she accepts the comfort you have provided, you feel a flash of satisfaction that all your research and effort has paid off. You are a good parent. Your child is content, and you have aided in that contentment. As baby grows, you continue to do your utmost to provide the best possible opportunities for the child's success. Each time your efforts are rewarded by him or her reaching a new milestone, another dose of dopamine is administered, and you take some credit for your child's accomplishment. One of your jobs as a new parent is to protect your infant from harm. This is natural and normal, as human babies cannot survive without parental aid. Each time we save our child from a boo-boo, ta-da! We are rewarded with another shot of feel-good juice. Each gift we present to them, every hug of thanks we receive from them, feeds our understanding that they love us and that we're good parents. We become so addicted to this euphoria of dopamine that we actively cultivate opportunities for the child to bestow their smiles upon us. Our child is special, and we take extraordinary pains to ensure that he or she lives every moment with that knowledge. We heap praise upon them for every little thing and ask nothing in return but a smile. And why not? That smile supplies us with our fix of confidence in our ability as parents. When the inevitable day arrives, when we are not rewarded with a smile or any gratitude at all, it certainly can't be the child's fault. It must absolutely be the result of us not satisfying their needs sufficiently well. And so we up the ante and provide more opportunities for them to offer us a reward. Now add to this scenario the public opinion poll of what a good parent is. The ruthless competition between parents to be the poster person of excellent parenting is exactly that. Ruthless. Good parents pack only the most gourmet of lunches. Good parents walk or drive their children to and from school. Good parents leave their jobs and other responsibilities to act as a courier service for items that their children have forgotten at home. Good parents provide name brand clothing and the latest and greatest electronic games. Good parents are not good parents if their child must face consequences for their mistakes, because truly good parents would not have allowed their child to make a mistake in the first place. The irony is that without mistakes from which to learn and recover, these oh-so-special and overloved children do not receive the opportunity to prove themselves to themselves, thereby remaining dependent on their parents and woefully lacking in self-confidence. So many well-intentioned parents go to the ends of the earth to ensure their child always feels loved and pampered and special, in no small part to ensure that their own dopamine is delivered on time and in abundance. The education systems, too, are the victims of the needs to have their students succeed. The reasons are different, but the results are the same. Schools are far more child-centered than they've ever been, and there are many very excellent reasons for it. Even so, I stand firm in my conviction that the feeling that we are the reason behind our children's successes is a driving motivator behind many of the behaviors we're witnessing at home, in school, and at work. Good intentions are the motivator, and the feel-good effects of dopamine are the ultimate prize. when you're addicted to it. Since 1970 or so, schools began to make an effort to serve students with special needs. Prior to that time, students experiencing difficulty with the curriculum were given as much extra attention as the teacher could or would provide, and any behavior problems arising from student frustration was solved via corporal punishment, aka the strap. If these two measures didn't solve the problem, the child was labeled a slow learner, or was simply branded as being bad, and in many cases written off as unable to be successful in life, the universe, or anywhere else. They may have been held back a year to repeat the courses, resulting in their peers labeling them the social pariahs of the schoolyard. Inappropriate behaviors would escalate, their self-esteem would take a serious beating, and the previous assumptions of the lack of possible success would prove themselves to be true. Parents were helpless because they had no power over the school systems and methods, and were in many cases too frightened of the authority within the school to question the treatment of their child. Now, as it does, the pendulum has swung to parents now claiming full authority over the ways their children are handled, and the teachers and administrators striving to keep everybody happy. Where there once was a handful of special needs students, today it seems that every individual has some special need or other, and it doesn't stop at graduation either. We have gone from children being seen and not heard to becoming a full-blown child-centric society, with youth demanding and receiving special attention at every turn. Business leaders are reeling from this. They don't know how to handle this new breed of employee. I don't know when and where the middle of the pendulum swing was, but clearly the momentum is too powerful to let it stop in the happy middle position. So what else is new? The needs of individuals have always needed to be considered. Neither end of the pendulum swing is appropriate. And although we strive for some sort of equilibrium, the human race has yet to pull it off. Through the ages, though, there has always been one special needs group who have never demanded and therefore never received any particular consideration aiding them in their search for success. The group is our overachievers, our high achievers, our leaders of the future. These are the kids that received honors grade throughout school, who went on to higher education or who started businesses. The ones who got away with a little bit of naughty because they could figure out how to do it without being caught. And they were the ones who knew how to take calculated risks and still come out ahead of the game. These individuals rarely receive any extra help because they don't ask for it, and just because they're successful within the limits of knowledge that are expected of them. Now, that doesn't mean that they wouldn't do even better with a modicum of assistance. These people, the bright and the curious, the spirited and the adventurous, are as much special needs as are the individuals with learning difficulties and or physical handicaps. Now, before anyone gets riled and ready to assault me in a dark alley, be reassured I am not denying that people with difficulties need and merit extra help. We absolutely must do everything we can to ensure they experience success to the absolute peak of their potential. No one is ever going to deny that. But what I'm saying is that we must also provide our high achievers with that same consideration. Furthermore, with special tutors, classroom aides, and psychologists being trained and ready to help the more usual special needs individuals, it is far more difficult for overachievers to find mentors and teachers to help them reach their highest potential limits. Let's bring this into the world of business. We are in an era in North America where the majority of the workforce has been raised knowing they are special. This group is currently wearing the labels of pampered and entitled and spoiled and so on. In fact, they are behaving exactly as they should, given the nature and circumstances of the world into which they were born. This group has more special needs than any before. At home, at school, they were taught they were destined for greatness, that they were special, and that there would always be a safety net to catch them should they fall. They are demanding, they are particular, and they will not abide the workplace hierarchies that have served us in the past. They are also brilliant, and they do have special needs, especially the highest achieving of them. In the business world, they can only reach their heights of accomplishment through a mentoring process. And herein lies the problem. Who is qualified to take on that role? We are in a rapid state of change. Technology has altered the systems we once used for building successful businesses and continues to do so with every day that passes. The mailroom, so often used as the icon of the bottom rung of the corporate ladder, no longer even exists. Standard business hours of 9 to 5 are almost obsolete. And meeting with overseas partners is now done while the parties are happily ensconced in their home offices. For some, these are newfangled procedures, but to the up-and-comers, they are already old news. They have never known the world without these technological advances. Yet, to be successful, they need to understand what has been to project and plan for what can be. They need to be taught, but they are reticent to ask for help because to do so would signify a gap in their brilliance. They need guidance, but they are so accustomed to having their every whim fulfilled without even asking, they don't understand that they have to ask for help. When any one of us needs assistance, who do we ask? Like as not, we turn to individuals we trust to help us sort out the problem. We may look for a sympathetic ear. We may look to a wise sage or a guide on the side. Even if the exact solution may not be forthcoming, we must have mentors. And therein lies the crux to beginning to solve the generational gap in business. Business leaders can no longer stand on command and control. They have to adapt to the workforce that exists. It's the leaders that have to change in order to close the generation gap, because the workforce doesn't know any other way than the way they've been taught. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for having a listen as I rant and rave. And Tanya, thank you for having me on the show.